Hi, this is Jules, and you're listening to the Somewhere for Us podcast. My guest today has been called a trailblazer by many, one of the UK's most cherished poets. She was born in Edinburgh, but grew up with parents Helen and John Kay in Glasgow, where she spent 20 years before moving to Manchester, where she lives today. Her work has been honoured by a myriad of awards, including the Garden Fiction Prize for her novel Trumpet. She is a poet, novelist, and writer of short stories. The author, Ali Smith, calls her the most fearless and most humane of poets. She was the third modern Macar, the National Poet for Scotland. For me personally, she's the first poet my wee one ever encountered. She is Jackie Kay. Hello, Jackie Kay.
Hello. Hello. Nice to see you.
Nice to see you too. I hope you can see me because you've
I
got smudgy glasses I can't help with any cleaning materials.
No.
I'm so sorry. You asked me if I had a hanky.
I know, hanky.
I don't think I've heard the word hanky.
Have you not?
Sometime.
Is that quite old-fashioned?
Not old-fashioned, but just something that doesn't get said anymore. Mm. You're making me think I should get a pack then. That's a good Secret Santa gift, right?
Yeah, definitely.
A pack of hankies. It's really lovely to have you here on Summer for Us podcast. You were one of the first people that appeared in the first issue of the magazine, which was really special for us. So it's really nice now on the publishing date of your latest collection of poetry for us to have a chat. I feel very blessed to be fit into your very busy schedule.
Oh, thank you. Well, it's lovely to be here and to see that you've got all of these now. They're so beautiful and dynamic looking. I mean, you've done such a lovely job. I remember when I was on for the first one, I was just really struck by the care that you take over the look and the feel of the magazine just as much as what's actually in it. And I think that's really special.
Yeah, that's nice to hear. Thank you. I can't take any credit. It was my colleagues. Well, I've had a glorious morning delving into your lovely, lovely collection. Real joy for me to spend some time with poetry, to really enjoy it and read it back to back.
Yeah, I think I wrote the book for them to be read together, almost like a congregation of voices.
Yeah.
Like a community, really. You know, a community of different people that would appear through time. And I like the idea of somebody sitting down and reading the poetry book like they would read a novel that they couldn't put down just from cover to cover. That's music to my ears.
Mm. What I wanted to ask you first, I think, is, you know, given that you're a novelist and you've written collections of stories and obviously poetry, why poetry now?
Well, poetry is always, I think, you know, it's what I started writing first. It's probably, I've written more collections of poetry than I have done any other form. It's probably the form that I'm the most comfortable in. And it's certainly the form that I can write when I can't write others. So I find that, you know, that a lot of the poems are about grief, or grief and protest really together, intertwined. And I found that poetry was the best form. It's most akin to song and protest. You know, we have a long, long history of protest songs. But also, you know, people often turn to poetry at times of great need, when they're grieving or when they're traumatised or when they're struck by something. And poets often write poems as well when they're under duress in one way or another. So it's the thing I can do. I couldn't write prose at the moment. My brain wouldn't work for prose. There's a certain kind of leap that you can take in a poem and a lot of space around it. There's a lot of space for a reader to come in and imagine. I mean, I like to think of poetry as a kind of a house of poetry, where somebody can come in, wander around
the rooms,
look out the windows, discover wee cupboards, maybe find a room that you didn't even know was in the house, a secret room, have a look in the bathroom cupboards. But I like the reader to be able to move through quite freely.
The Daughters and Neighbours poem I found really moving because it spoke to lots of different things in my life in regards to living here through COVID and 2020. And there's a neighbour I have over there who lost someone with their coffin brought through the street. And it was so much in that poem for me that spoke, although you know, talking about loss in a different way in relation to your mother's, just anybody talking about the value of finding
community in your neighbourhood,
yeah,
which is, feels like it was really lost before COVID, and I definitely rediscovered it,
yeah,
through that time.
I think that was definitely one of the things that happened during COVID. Shall I read that poem since we're talking about it? So as your listeners get
I would absolutely love
borrow your copy.
Yeah, absolutely.
Daughters, neighbours for Elaine. Friend, you saved me through the window, a wave, a glass raised, a kid on knife at the throat. All our pantomimes played out like Rear Window, moved on to suburban Glasgow. And then came sorrow. Your mammy's hearse pushed uphill in the snow. My mum following 10 days later. The snow still thick in our street. Now who are we, my dear friend? What are we without our mothers? We who loved them through these long, long years. Here we are, both turning 60, walking grief's long corridor to the open window, the open door, knowing we could not have given more. We could not have given more.
Thank you. What was the meaning behind repeating that last line?
I originally had, we could not have given anything more, took out the anything, and liked it just being repeated, we could not have given more, because we were two people in our 60s that looked after our parents. I was in with my mum and dad for really more or less the last 5 years. Oops, that's them. I'll keep that here just in case we go to another poem.
That's good.
I was kind of in their house looking after them more or less for the last 6 years of their life, and Elaine was looking after her mother, and so we'd often appear in the windows, you know, you could see into each other's kitchen windows, and we'd often have these mimes, like, you know, sometimes we'd kind of go like that, or, you know, because it was very challenging as well, looking after people and doing that and trying to kind of do your life. So it was really exhausting but really rewarding, and we wouldn't have done anything differently, and we couldn't have given any more, and it needed to be kind of double emphasized because there's so many people in that position up and down the lengths of the country and across the world who look after aging parents with very little acknowledgement, with a lot of sometimes isolation, very little understanding, and a huge amount of responsibility, from giving medicines to giving insulin to checking blood pressures to changing catheter bags to operating chairlifts to operating wheelchairs, all of that stuff, and very, very little acknowledgement, and even worse now from our government at the moment and how it's treating people. So it's double emphasized because, you know, people that are in that position do give an awful lot, and you need to say it twice.
Yeah, I'm glad you did. There's people I know who need to hear it twice.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Thank you for that. Well, let's just take a beat back for a moment and tell the listeners what we're talking about. So this is your brand new collection. It publishes today, April 25th, 2024. It sounds like it's come at, a really good time for you, in terms of maybe where you're at in the grief journey. Is it something you feel able to talk about, and you're able to represent the poems now in a way that maybe was harder earlier? Or
yeah, that's a nice question. Thank you. Yes, I think so. I think you know, the thing about grief is it is very solitary. Even when people are all in a family grieving the same person, they grieve that person in very different ways, and often that can create conflict in families because people don't feel that other people are doing enough or whatever, and often people have terrible rows.
Or they remember people differently.
Or they pick out different things that they loved about them, exactly. So grief, even when it's a family member and you're from a large family, is a solitary affair. And it's only really when you find a way to make it communal, in whatever way that happens to be for you, that it starts to feel as if it's shifting. And I think that when I realised that the poems themselves were starting to congregate, if you like, in my hall, I realised that the poems were having conversations with each other and that they needed to be in a book. And that felt like it felt like companionship. It felt like the comrades that had been with my mum and dad all their lives were suddenly gathering to be with them now. The living and the dead ones, all the comrades that are in the book are not all dead, but, you know, the Mick McGackie dead, Paul Robeson dead, Harry Bolifonte dead, but died after my mum. So But there's lots of living comrades in the book too, and their life was kind of peopled with different, really colourful characters. I mean, Paul Robeson, we had a photograph of him on our mantelpiece, and he was like a member of the family. He'd just be referred to as Paul, and Angela Davis would just be referred to as Angela, Nelson Mandela as Nelson. It was just like all these characters that were formed part of your...
But they're in your hearts, weren't they?
They formed part
of who you are.
Exactly. They were in the chamber of the heart, the big room, the big room in the heart.
The big room. I went down a hole looking at Paul Robeson's life, and it was really fascinating. I had found that I've got lots of family who come from Wales, and I noticed that there was a film, I think it was the last film that he made.
It's beautiful, that
in
piece of
Wales.
Film.
I've never seen that.
It's wonderful.
So it's called The Proud Valley, 1940. And what it immediately brought to mind for me, because it's set in a Welsh mining town or village, is the film Pride, which was like a 2014 film, which for our community has been a real success in terms of telling, you know, kind of intersecting the stories and the struggles and the strifes of different marginalised and minority communities, and bringing kind of politics together in a way that perhaps hadn't been done before on screen. And I feel now people should watch The Proud Valley and then watch Pride.
Yes.
So they can see the history of just the depth of the significance of that, of the stories of that community supporting the LGBTQ+ community at that time.
Yeah.
I've never done it. I'd love to screen it back to back.
I think it's a great idea. Absolutely brilliant idea. And I think, you know, often people don't know. I mean, Paul Robeson was so loved in Wales. He was so loved in Scotland. He also went and sang just to the mining community in Wales. And there's a lovely bit of video of that that you can get on YouTube. If you put in Paul Robeson, I think it's Joe Hill that he sings to them. But you see all these faces of people that have just come out that, up from the pit, and they're all gathered around all of these miners, and there's Paul singing to them. It's just about one of the most affecting little pieces of film that you can see. It's on YouTube. I remember finding that and playing that to my mum and dad, you know, because that was how we spent a lot of our latter evenings, me finding things for them that they would really enjoy, and them kind of screening kind of crowding my tiny kind of laptop round the next bent down, and my dad's going, "That's miraculous. You can get that on your computer. How did you find that?" And you'd think I was some kind of extraordinary magician that was able to conjure Paul Robeson 1 minute and Ella Fitzgerald the next minute. And, you know, so it was just like going through their lifetime's favourites.
I lost my dad in 2014. And so he had to spend, he got an iPad going through chemo. And just because there's a lot of time whiled away, sat in a chair, you know. And I remember when he first discovered YouTube.
Yeah.
And just spent hours on YouTube. Couldn't believe the stuff that he could look up. Clips of all sorts of bits and pieces that he used to love. But he thought it was magic. Absolutely magic. He went down many a YouTube hole.
Yeah. It's really easy to do. The rabbit holes.
The rabbit holes, that's it. The title of the collection is May Day. So when I read the collection, there are definitely poems in there that move me. You also touch on the idea of grief not just moving you, but moving you to act in some way. Is there a calling in it?
Yeah, I think that, I think that the book is a kind of, the title is a pun on both senses of May Day. So there's the May Day of the 1st of May marches and worker celebrations that happened the world over. The May Day marches that we used to go on, referring to the kind of May Day bank holiday that we still have, that a lot of people don't know that May Day bank holiday is actually the day for the workers.
Workers' rights, yeah.
The workers'
rights
day.
I didn't know that until I read your work.
Yeah, so a lot of, and I really want to remind people of that, because it's important that people know the history and their rights. So that was one reason that I called the book May Day, and to celebrate all the May Days that I'd been on as a kid, the May Day marches, to celebrate that part of my life, really. I mean, I was 5 months old when I was taken on my first demo. We've got a photograph of it because it was in the paper of my mum holding me and 5 months and my brothers in a pram being pushed by Hugh McDermott on an anti-Polaris march.
I took my little one at 5 months on an anti-Trump March, so actually.
It's really good. It's really, really good. So I think that, you know, the tradition, we have a long tradition of protest songs, protest marches.
There's a lot of songs in it.
Yeah, and I think that that's really important. But the other May Day in the book is the May Day call for alarm that comes from the French, Venez May Day, which is May Day, May Day, May Day. And that's the May Day when it's joined up with an exclamation. And it's said three times to signal an alarm as a shipping,
A
shipping thing. So there's both in the title. It's a pun.
Issue 15 of the Somewhere Frost magazine is out now. Izzy Med has created another standout cover for the issue called We Are Family. And if you're not already part of the Somewhere family, for exclusive gifts and your very own copies of our quarterly magazine, visit somewherefrost.org and sign up today. We want to keep supporting queer artists' enterprise, exploring our culture and celebrating our heritage. And your support helps us to tell those stories and make sure they're never forgotten. Discover more at somewherefrost.org.
I didn't realise you went to Stirling University. I went to Stirling University.
Did you? Did you like it?
Yeah, I did. But I was kind of... The reason I bring it up is I was really deeply saddened to hear what a rough time that you'd had there.
Mm.
And I sort of went down a bit of a sort of reflection of my part, just thinking about how different it would have been for the people of colour and the black people that I knew around me at that time, and whether there was any differences, whether there were any major shifts in 1998 when I went, from when you were there.
Mm. 20 years. Wait, 20 years.
Mm. Yeah. And were you writing poetry then?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. I was writing poetry then. And I mean, it was an extraordinary time because I went to Stirling in 1979. I joined the Anti-Nazi League group at the university. I joined the Women's Collective and the Gay Sock. And,
I was in a derivative of that group, but
yeah,
10, 15, 18 years later.
Yeah, so that was really fantastic because these were the beginning of women's consciousness raising groups. There was even a men's consciousness raising group that I knew. I had kind of men friends that went to that. I was fascinated to find out what went on in the men's consciousness raising, and I could never, and I always thought of self-raising flower or something. I had this image of it in my head because of the raising, the unexpected use of that word raising. It was kind of, it seemed to be in the wrong place, but anyway. And yeah, but there was also groups of fascists at the university that put up posters with my name on it and the name of one of my best friends who was gay. And we were both offered police protection, though we didn't take it because we didn't trust the police. But they put these razor blades behind the posters, so as anybody that tried to pull them down would get their hands damaged. And I remember organising a meeting to speak out about that. And at that time I was reading Angela Davis's book, and she had quoted James Baldwin, who'd been talking about the supporting the Soledad brothers, and it said, you know, said to basically it's a kind of call to comradeship, really, you know, if they come for us in the morning, if you haven't spoken out, there'll be nobody there. Yeah. And so I remember saying that at that meeting and thinking the only way to respond to being threatened was to be even more visible. Not to be invisible, but to be more visible. So that's, yeah, I remember 300 people attending that meeting and it being one of these key life-changing moments. But the interesting thing was that the university just wanted it all covered up. They didn't want it to be a news story. They didn't want it to get out because they'd already had bad press when they threw tomatoes at the Queen a few years earlier.
Oh gosh, that when she was there to open it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, because it only opened in the early 70s, didn't it?
Exactly, yeah. So it was 67, I think it was 67.
Oh, okay. Yeah. So yeah, but it was still quite a young university when you were there.
It was.
I wonder if that's shifted. I wonder if universities are representing in a new kind of way now.
No, I think universities go to lengths still to try and dampen down anything that might damage the institution's reputation. You know, I think if a university had a problem with student suicide, and the biggest problem, Stirling had the biggest record of student suicide in the whole of Europe, that was something that you could find out about, but not something that the university took on and said, now listen, we've got this problem and this is how we're dealing with it. And you still have that problem today. Universities have huge challenges with students that have isolation, mental health, neurodivergent students that are not getting the support that they need. And instead of actually just going straight to that and saying this is how we're dealing with that, a lot of universities hide that kind of thing, and that's the best universities actually tackle it. But you see from COVID and from the ways in which different universities dealt with COVID, and some universities, you know, some in Manchester actually arresting students and things for, so, you know, that was really, really appalling and really bad for Manchester University's reputation, how they dealt with COVID.
Much work to do.
Yeah. I think schools are the same. Schools, you know, they go to lengths to want to protect their own reputation rather than actually think, let's see what this is saying about a broader picture of what's going on in society, and let's think of how we can contribute and make changes in our community.
Yeah, it feels familiar across a lot of different institutions, actually.
Mm. Yeah, I think hospitals mm-hmm. are the same.
I was thinking of hospitals, that's what I was thinking.
Prisons, same.
Hmm.
Stitch-up jobs, a lot of them.
I didn't realise we were going to go there, but we went there. Did you meet Maya Angelou?
Yes, I did.
Can you say a little bit about that? I would love to hear that.
Yeah, I met her. I was actually sent to interview her by Marxism Today, which doesn't exist anymore, but it used to be a really great magazine. And I was 22, 23. And she was, she was in her late 60s. And she was 6'4". And really imposing. I went to a house in Islington where she was staying with her publishers or people connected to her publishing house, and she was just fantastic. She was so, I mean, she spoke so eloquently, and she had a great sense of humour, a great sense of fun. She was very theatrical. She moved a lot. She moved her hands a lot, And at first, I think she just thought, oh, I'm just like going to be this young woman that doesn't know that much. I mean, she'd maybe been on a roll of having to do one interview with another and was, you know.
Much like you are today with me.
Exactly. Who can blame her? So she was maybe just thinking, oh. And so it took a while for me to prove myself, if you like, to her. And she said, at one point I said to her that I'd read in one of her books that there was such a thing as the Maya character, because she had written these autobiographies, but that she was writing about herself as a character and there was the Maya character. And she said, no, I didn't write that. I don't believe I said that anywhere, but I like that and I'm having it. I'm going to refer to it from this day on, the Maya character. That's very, very good. So the whole conversation changed from that on. I was like, yay.
That's amazing.
But there was a photographer there that day who was taking pictures as we were talking, and the photographer was really nervous and knocked down their own lights, and the lights went crashing to the floor, and it was a big noise. So I just kind of went like that and turned around like you would.
Yeah.
And Maya didn't turn around and look at the things at all. She just kept looking straight at me, and she said, I'm giving you my full attention, now you give me yours. So that was a bit scary.
Wow, I feel like she earned the right to be scary.
Oh yeah, good. Yeah. And the third thing was that she said to me, you bring great joy into the world, which is a lovely thing to say after having only been with me for a couple of hours. And I said, actually, the name on my original birth certificate is Joy. And she said, was it really? Wow. So she signed all my books that I had, you know, I Know Why the Caged Bird Sings, Gathering Together in My Name. She signed all of those for Joy.
Which
was really lovely. Then after we finished the interview, I gave her one of my Regal cigarettes, and she gave me an American one that was twice the length. And we stood outside.
I mean, that's just typical, isn't it?
We stood outside, me with this kind of limousine of a cigarette and her with this wee mini. And that was the time. So I remember it
now
all.
Now, that would have been a picture.
Well, I got the whole interview on tape. I came across that tape the other day, actually.
Did you?
Yeah, because it was all taped, yeah. And I'm about to sell... My archives are about to go into the National Library of Scotland in Edinburgh.
Wonderful.
So that's the kind of thing that will be digitised.
Oh,
and people
it really
will be,
needs to
people
be.
People will be able to listen to it.
Yeah, it really, really needs to be.
Yeah, but you heard the story here first, much, much better.
There we go, a bit of an exclusive for somewhere for us. I love it. I love it. Tell me a little bit about where you're going next. So we've got this wonderful collection that's published today and it's out there now. And then I've read that you are, or you have been on a bit of an expedition.
Yeah, well,
towards your next book.
Yeah, the next book that I'm already writing. It's always a good idea to be writing something when you have a book out, because otherwise, yes, it stops you in your tracks for too long.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah, so the next book is kind of working title is High Road, Low Road, and it really just asks the question of if you can still belong to a country when your parents have died. Because your relationship shifts quite dramatically. You know, I find I was in Glasgow yesterday, and I find just arriving in Glasgow Central Station and just being in Glasgow quite painful, really. I'm hoping that will change, because I do love Glasgow.
Yeah.
But it just feels like a home alone city. Feels very different now that my mum and dad and my brother are not in it.
That's... There's just a lot. Just a lot of loss around that.
Yeah. But. Well, Glasgow to me is, you know, it's a great character city, and it's got a great personality as a city, and great characters that live in it with kind of, you know, way of speaking and a sense of humour and particular ways that you might think of as quintessentially Glaswegian. And to get that enjoyment of that completely. You have to have a real connection to it. And obviously I'll always be connected to Glasgow because I'm Glaswegian, but it just feels a big shift.
Our Somewhere For Us magazine has featured interviews with many of Scotland's inspiring LGBTQ+ role models and icons, including actors Alan Cumming and Annie Wallace, authors Douglas Stewart and Eli Percy, singers like Horace McDonald and Finn Brodie, and sports people Bruce Mowat and Robin Love, and many more. Discover more at somewhereforus.org.
So that's the book that I'm trying to write, and also it's about going back to places that I went to at different points, like a place like Auchincairn, or Egg, or Colonsay, or Ardnamurchan, and revisiting it and seeing a kind of now and then of the place, what the current issues are in the place, what's happening. It's really that. A travel book, really.
Mm.
And maybe with some whiskey thrown in some foods thrown in.
Nice.
So I really like trying different forms, and I've never tried to write a travel book before. But when I was writing Red Dust Road, my memoir, I really actually liked describing places from Aberdeen to Lagos, you know, from Enugu to Glasgow. I like trying to actually recreate the places and the character of the places, and so I think I'll try my hand. I mean, who knows? But the other book that's coming out before then is a book that's coming out next year in January called Cúri Dún, and it's my first children's book for 3-year-olds and up.
Fantastic!
And it's illustrated by an artist who lives in Edinburgh, Jill Calder. And it's a bedtime story with Scottish words in it. The little characters, black Scottish girl called Shona. I'm more excited about that book than any book I've ever had, because it's got pictures and it looks so beautiful, and it really, really moves you. Mm. And I can just imagine children of different ages going right up to, a reader is going right up to their 90s, because I like the idea of maybe great-grandparents reading it to their grandchildren, because it hopefully will span the generations.
Oh, I imagine it will. It's a really good time for me to thank you for the poem you wrote to my wee one, which I received in the baby box. And it's going to move me thinking about it, but to have a little one especially in a queer family, and it took so long to have him that it felt really, I don't know, it's quite powerful just having a gay writer writing a poem to be the first poem that my little one will ever hear in the world on the day he was born. But for it to be in a box provided by the government, you know, that was quite quite something.
Oh, that's lovely. Well, it's interesting because I read somewhere that Nicola Sturgeon's government were going to be making a box of essential things. So I wrote to the government, as you do, and I said, how about considering a poem
did
to
be...
Did
you make that happen?
Yeah, I did, yeah.
I did not know that.
They wouldn't have, I don't think, thought of it, but I wrote to them and said, would you consider a poem to be an essential thing? And they wrote back and said, actually, yes, we would, but we need it in 2 days' time. So I stayed up through the night to write that poem 2 nights in a row because although it's a small, simple poem, I just had to get it right. So I went through probably more drafts and more different changes than just about any poem that I ever wrote. And I wanted it to be partly in Old Scots so as people reading it would be able to... be able to tell their children when they grew up.
I was thinking about the generational...
The generations.
Travelling that it'll do.
Yeah, and I wanted it to have a sense of, because if I put it in Old Scots, it would already feel like it was a tradition. It had a tradition behind it. But when it first came out, it created a huge furore, that poem. And I was involved in my first kind of toxic experience of social media, which was really upsetting for me. And lots of people,
lots of people
on Mumsnet objected to it and said that I was trying to make women that had postnatal depression feel terrible about themselves and things. And I thought, how do you write a welcome poem to a baby from the point of view of a postnatally depressed mum? I don't know how I would have done that. But anyway, the poem.
No, but you couldn't also be the voice of every parent who's birthing a child. That's just not something you could do.
No.
What I heard in that was you.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's what meant something to me because I felt proud of you. So I felt like if there's going to be any poetry, you know, entering the ears of my little one, I want it to be you.
Well, thank you.
And I heard you in it, and I'm glad you're in it.
You've made it all better, all the hurt from those years. But it's interesting because, you know, I also decided that I would handwrite it, and I chose the paper myself, and I delivered it to the government. I delivered it to the government offices myself, having chosen the exact colour of paper, having handwritten it and all the rest of it. And I kind of wanted it to be wrapped in a little red ribbon, but they couldn't do that because it would have got squashed with the other things. So it had to be flat. But anyway,
it was pristine when we arrived.
Well, that's good. So that was really nice. But then when the poem came out, you know, there was all this furore about the old Scots words and the furore about that. Even the handwriting, somebody said, what a horrible font. And it was my own handwriting.
I mean, you've got to reframe that, Jackie. You've got to reframe that to being like, oh my God, horrible font.
Yeah, horrible font.
What's your handwriting style? Horrible font.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, it's not Verdana. It's not Verdana.
Listen, you shared
all.
A cigarette with Maya Angelou. These people can just do one.
But it was very funny. But actually now, when people are asked what's their favourite thing in the baby box, it's a poem.
So absolutely,
you've just got to see these things through. And actually, for anybody that's ever going through any difficult time with either a bunch of friends or on social media, it will pass, and you have to just see it through because it's just ridiculous. Some of these things are just ridiculous, the kind of amount of toxicity and hatred and people getting themselves all up in arms about things and in judgment. You know, this is the age of judgment where people pronounce and opinionate about all sorts of things.
It's
that
really
you would
polarizing, isn't it?
Really polarizing, upsetting. But you just have to think, this too will pass.
This too shall pass. And there's also, I like to think about the lack of care that's in it and see that as a positive thing, because you can say really, really horrible things, especially if you're good with words. You can say really, really horrible things and use words as weapons very, very, very quickly with very little care behind it. Like really very little thought, very little kind of, you know, plotting, or it's just, it really is just sort of spilled out into the world, and it can have this huge damage. But I would also say to the people who are experiencing, especially from our community, who are experiencing hate online, is there's so little care behind it. So you should don't give it the care that isn't in the words.
Yeah, that's a good way to look at it, actually. That's a really good way to think about it. Yeah, I remember my mum used to say to me if I came home crying because somebody had said something racist to me, she'd say to me, "Don't give them your tears, Jackie. They don't deserve it. They've not even thought hard enough. Don't give them your tears." And it was really good advice. But then she'd turn it and say, "If you give them your tears, I'll get angry with you." Oh, that's you. Sorry. So it was like, oh God, it was a fun.
I've heard that you're a great imitator.
Yeah, yeah.
And I can tell that.
Well, I've done Maya and my mother for me. Who's next?
Who's next? Who's next? I love it. I love it.
So, you're new to the Somewhere For Us podcast. There are so many episodes available right now. People who are doing amazing things for LGBTQ plus visibility and representation and for queer community in Scotland. But also people whose stories and memories reach beyond the familiar. It's a place where we can learn about each other, find out where we've been and where we're headed. Together, I hope. Listen to Conversations Now with John Bell, Eli Percy, all the Hebridean Baker, Ellen Galford, and so many more. So let's connect. Follow me on Instagram, Spotify, leave us a review on Apple Podcasts, or you can find all episodes at somewhereforus.org/podcast.
Can you talk a little bit about community? And what's that meaning for you now? Because you're living down in Manchester, is that right?
Mm,
yeah, mm. So you're away from Scotland. And just thinking about, I guess, with your book in mind and what you're looking to explore there in terms of, you know, what that means, what Scotland means to you, what Glasgow means to you now. What does, is community taking a different form for you now?
Well, I've lived in Manchester a number of years now, since my son was 7 and he's 35 now. And he's just... one of his films has just gone on Netflix yesterday. He's a documentary filmmaker. He made a film about TLC, TLC Forever. So that just launched yesterday. So we're having a good time, the two kids. And he's also got another one on Netflix called Little Miss Sumo, about a woman sumo wrestler. So, you know, I feel really excited that I have a 35-year-old son in the world who's very talented and wonderful filmmaker. But I think if I'd brought him up in Scotland, he wouldn't be the person that he is.
Well, that's interesting. And, can you say a bit more about that?
Yeah, because he's confidently and easily black. He brought up with lots and lots of friends that were his colour or darker, and were all very at ease. And it's hard to get that in a community, just really in any Scottish city then, with ease and be the child of a lesbian mother. So I really chose where to live for my child, for him to be, have other black kids. There was only one other lesbian mother I knew at the time, and she had a son that when he was aged 11 was quite confident about having a lesbian mum, which mine wasn't then. And his email address when emails first came in was sonofalesbian.com.
Son of a lesbian. I feel like that's an exclamation.
It feels like it should be a rock song, you know.
Son of a lesbian.
It should be sung, you know. But I remember saying to my son when he was like 16, I said to him, it's quite cool, you know, Matthew, having a lesbian mum. And he went, it's not cool at all. He said, and he paused for a second, he went, it'd be cool to have a lesbian gran. So I phoned my mum and I told her that night, and she said, "Jackie, what am I supposed to do at this late stage? Change my sexuality? I don't think so." and it was really great. But now he's like 35. He's perfectly relaxed about having a lesbian mum. Probably uses it in applications for funding for the documentaries.
Brilliant.
So that also is something that you just, you know, you go through changes. And I had a huge community of other black lesbians that I knew in London. I went to the first OWAD, Organisation of Women of African and Asian Descent, which is in Mayday. And that made a kind of profound difference in my life, meeting these other black lesbians when I thought I was the only one in the world. It was just so exciting, such an exciting time. So I stayed in London and had that community around me for a long time. And then when I moved to Manchester, there's a whole other community. I mean, where I live in Manchester, in Chaltern, there's probably more vegan lesbians per square square meter than just about anywhere else in the country apart from Hebden Bridge. So you know, and there's a whole kind of community in Charlton. It's a fantastic place to live, and all sorts of independent shops that all support each other, and it's a very, very caring community to live in. So yeah, I like it a lot, and I like the idea. I like big multicultural cities where people are just at ease, and it's, you know, you're not remarked upon all the time. That gets very tiresome, and that still happens in Scotland. The thing is, a lot of people are already here. It's just that we don't get to hear from them. There are huge communities, Afro-Caribbean communities, actually in Edinburgh. When you go to, you know, I do events, and suddenly you'll see 100 people, but you won't necessarily see people at the Lyric Theatre if you're at something, or at even Edinburgh Book Festival. It's as if people haven't actually all connected to find who people are and actually give people a voice. So I think there's an awful lot more work that needs to be done.
Do you have a sense of what that work is?
I think it's making connections and reaching out, and also listening to people, giving people a voice. I think there's a history of things being the wrong way around, basically.
Is there anyone you would like Somewhere for Us podcast to speak to?
Oh, you could speak to Hannah Lavery. She was the Edinburgh Macker. She's really fantastic. Nadine Issa-Jassat, fantastic. Suzanne Bonner, just the most amazing Black Scottish jazz singer who should be, you know, world known. And probably if she'd moved down to England when she was 20, she would be by now. So I think, sadly, England has a better history of making different Black people that live in England visible than Scotland does. There's very few. And the image of being Scottish is not something that you see as being a Black person.
About this.
Yeah. Well, we just look around you from you know, shortbread tins to what you see on tourist board pictures. You hardly ever see any people of colour in that. Whereas that has changed faster and at a different rate. And, you know, a city like Glasgow or Edinburgh, these cities are founded in money from the slave trade. Mm-hmm. Liverpool's already got its own museum talking about that. London did the same thing years ago, 20, 25 years ago. So even that Black History
Tour. So new.
I know, but even that Black History Tour, that's only just started, like last year. You know, you're talking about having these things 25, 30 years.
And it's not funded well.
No, so Scotland is behind like that, and they need to do an awful lot of work. And every time I say something like this, I get lots of hate and things back, but, you know, I don't give a flying basically. I've still got to speak out.
Yeah, for sure. And also, just, you know, the level of care in that hate, it's just not there.
Yeah, and I'm going to keep that. That's a good thing to the level
match
of care.
It with the care that
I think
you're
that's
given.
A really good way to think. Yeah, I'm going to take that. I'm going to take it.
Say that in a Maya Angelou voice.
I think I'm going to take that. That's very interesting that you should say that. It's really, that struck me anew. And still I rise.
I love it. You took us back to 1983 just a minute ago, and I think you were at London Pride in 1984.
Yeah.
And you write about it in your book. Would you mind reading that poem for us?
Yeah, sure.
No, sorry, it's a section of...
It's a section of the poem. Yes, because the whole poem would be 7 minutes, 27 seconds, which somebody told me one time when I read it.
Wow.
I said, this is quite a long poem, and somebody came up to me at the end and went, that poem took 7 minutes, 27 seconds. Oh, thank you. I didn't ask for that.
Thank you very much. Okay, yeah, and just maybe the title of the poem and give it a little bit of context, if that's okay.
Yeah. So this comes from A Life in Protest, which was one of the poems that when I wrote it, I realised that I was actually writing a book rather than just a single poem. The other poems started to gather with this one. And this tells the story of really the role that protests can have throughout your life, you know, beginning with me as a little baby on an anti-Polaris march and ending with my mum in her turquoise armchair with her I May Be Old But I Voted Remain badge on. This is from a bit in the poem. 1984, marching with pride through London, lesbians and gay men dressed to impress, me with my double-headed axe, yes, my denim dungarees, bless, my pink triangle badge, my red kickers, don't mess with me, sing if you're glad to be gay, sing if you're happy that way, hey, watching people, watching us, out in the streets, staring, shouting, peering into the depths of us, like we were barely human, strange new creatures, many feathered, flamboyant. Sheridan.
Jackie Kay, I feel so honoured that you spent some time with me today in this busy schedule on the day of your publishing that wonderful work, May Day, published by Picador. And be available all over, I imagine.
Yeah, it's already reprinting. It's sold out already, which is amazing. It's not published just today, but it's sold out on early orders. So that's that's quite nice. It just seems to be striking a chord with people.
I think so. Struck a chord with me. So thank you so much.
Thanks.
Order it from independent and buy it from independent bookstores as well. Thank you, Jackie Kay.
Thank you so much for having me.
You're very welcome.
Bye.
Thanks for listening. I hope you enjoyed the conversation as much as I did. There is a growing number of episodes to explore wherever you're listening, and I'd really appreciate you subscribing, whether that's through Spotify or Apple Podcasts, or giving me a follow on Instagram. I will do my best to keep the posts coming because I really do want people to find out about Somewhere for Us, to keep supporting us. And I want to thank the players of the People's Postcode Lottery for helping to make this episode possible. I'm Jules, and this is Somewhere for Us.